Taking a look at the interesting world of insects now with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Really glad to have you listening in and happy to have Phil back. And if you have a question about a bug, maybe there's one that's kind of bugging you, go join in. Or maybe just a question about insects in general. A particular one that you've found or seen, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
What kinds of questions are you getting at the lab these days?
Well, you know, gypsy moth is quite active, but I think if I had to pick a bug of the month so far, there's a critter called a four-line plant bug, and it's really interesting. The adult is either yellowish or kind of a lime green with four black lines down the back. It would remind you of a cucumber beetle. The immature stage is like a small box elder bug. It's kind of orangish red with black legs and the like. Feeds on a variety of plants, and it burns little holes in the leaves. And so I see it on herbs like mint and in basil, but I've seen it on sunflower. So it's been very prevalent. I've even seen it on viburnums this year. And we're at that transition now that they're going to the adult stage. To be honest, the damage is over, but your first read on the leaf is it's got some kind of plant disease, because it really looks like some kind of leaf spot or whatnot. And, you know, I don't really think I understand what causes them to have a good year, but they're definitely, I said, probably one of the more prominent samples I'm seeing right now.
Betty in Slinger, Wisconsin, emailed, and she's having a great year for red spider mites. She said she's got a bunches of them, thousands of them in her yard and on her patio. Are they harmful? How do you get rid of them is her question.
Well, what I wonder is if it's not, you know, when I think of spider mite, I think of something that feeds on your roses and can cause problems. And those are typically a problem during very hot, dry periods. There is something that we call a velvet mite that is bright red in color. And velvet mites don't hurt plants. But if a lot of times around rock mulch and whatnot, you'll see a lot of things crawl around. In fact, I even had a call yesterday about somebody said they were all over her lawn furniture. You know, they really are predators on insect eggs and other things, so they really don't pose a lot of problems. Now, if you sit on them, you could probably cause a little bit of a stain and the like. And so somebody insists, I think even a soapy water spray would be more than adequate to knock them down. But I wouldn't worry about them causing problems on the plants, because they said they're not, even though they are red and they are a spider mite, like, they're not the true red spider mite, which is usually not red, by the way. okay. And as I said, it hasn't been the kind of weather to have spider mite problems in the state, I don't think.
Jill in Wautoma has a question for you. Hi, Jill. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a home on a river in Wautoma, and we swim in the river often. On the bottom stairs that is attached to the river, we see these very large, long-legged black spiders. And my question is, should we be concerned about these biting us, or should we get rid of them, or are they harmless?
Sure. I'm guessing they are what we would call a fishing spider. The genus is Dolomites, and they're the biggest, ugliest spider that I know of in the state. they really are harmless. I mean, I suppose if you could catch one, and I bet you that would really be quite a challenge, and were to handle it, you would get bit. But that's what it takes. You know, by nature, they're not aggressive. The only thing is, though, is I guess when you have guests over, you have to kind of warn them, because I said just because of the sheer size and whatnot, people really are taken aback when they see them. But I would just let them be. They are capable of catching small fish at times. The British call them raft spiders because they can almost kind of float on the water. But you can also see them a pretty good distance away from the water. And so the name fishing spider is a little bit deceptive, but definitely nothing to worry about.
All right. There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling. And Diane in Edgar, Wisconsin, sent some photos of a moth fluttered by the lilacs like a hummingbird, wings not clear, brown colored with rust stripes, total wingspan about 3 inches, body had two yellow stripes at the bottom like a bumblebee and a brown tail fan, body about 2 inches long.
Sure. From what I can see, it is definitely a hawk moth. And we also call these sphinx moths, but with those two yellow bands on the abdomen, it reminds me of Abbott's sphinx, which is a particular species. If they weren't black and white, I could be 100% positive, but I'm pretty confident that's probably what it is. And, you know, the larvae of these are all hornworms, although they don't all have horns. Adults tend to be active at night. have this very long proboscis, which is often as long, if not longer, than the body, and it's curled up. And then when they feed, they put this, so they can feed very deep into flowers that have very deep centers on them. And this particular species she has is a little less common. The white-lined sphinx is probably the most common one we see, and there's probably a grand total of about 20 species you could find in the state.
Let's go to Diane in Michicott now. Hi, Diane.
Hi, just wanted to say how much I appreciate your program, and it's so very interesting. And also listening, you saved me having to look up my extension agent
okay.
in the phone book. So I'm having a little problem with finding foam on some of my soft leaf plants and on my strawberry plants. It's maybe an eighth of an inch wide, and it looks like concentrated little soap bubbles.
Sure.
I'm spittle bugs?
I'm sorry, what?
Spittle bugs, do you think?
Yeah, it's the immature stage of the spittle bug. And when it transforms into the adult, it no longer makes that foamy mass. Mm-hmm. But basically, that's plant sap that they are pushing out of their body and pumping air into it. And that sticky, gooey mass protects them from predators and also the sun. They seem to be a little bit sensitive, I think, to desiccation. A problem in May and early June, very visible, but honestly not that harmful to the plants. I will say if they're excessively heavy, I've seen the plants not elongate properly. We call that rosetting, you know, where they just don't stretch out. So that would be a symptom, but so often it's one here, one there. I would only be concerned if let's say on my cone flowers, it was one every stem. I mean, those kind of numbers get me a little bit nervous. In strawberries, it's more of the mess of you know, picking berries. If they're particularly thick, you get that kind of foamy mass on stuff, and it just gets your hands sticky. But the good news is we're making that transition now into the adult stage, and it really will not be much of an issue for more than another week or so.
Oh, good news.
I've just been pinching it off with my fingers.
Sure, and that's fine. And sometimes you'll find that the nymph has already left the mass. If you tease them out, they will either be almost a yellowish green, a straight green, or almost orange. They come in kind of two or three colors, even as all still the meadow spittlebug. And they have big googly eyes, almost like a frog, and they hop. They can jump. And so that's it kind of reminds me of I mean, it's not totally frog-like, but at least the face reminds me of the frog.
Thanks, Diane.
Oh, thank you so much for the information.
Sure. Brian in Cedarburg, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I've got quite a few acres of restored prairie on my property, and over the years, a lot of Canada goldenrod has filled in. And this year, I've got a worm. It's a black worm, about a half inch, 3/8 of an inch long, which is eating it all up.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked on the internet for biological control of Canada goldenrod, and there's nothing there.
Right.
Are you aware of this worm?
Yeah. What I'm guessing it is the larval stage of one of the leaf beetles, because there's a very common one on goldenrod that's kind of black and even almost a warty skin to it. But it really isn't biological control. I mean, this is an insect that's evolved with goldenrod. So it will cause some feeding and knock the plant back a little bit. But all in all, I don't think it has enough of an impact to say that it would control the goldenrod. As typical of native insect populations, it'll ebb and flow on its own. So it's not as if it's very serious every year. The adult beetle will be, if it's who I think it is, kind of a very soft yellowish tan body with somewhat indistinct greenish markings on it. It reminds you of kind of a big cucumber beetle. It's about twice the size, and to be honest, it's in the same family as cucumber beetles. Most of the chrysomelid leaf beetles are very host specific, and so you find one on goldenrod and that's all it will feed on, and this is one of those classic examples. I'm not sure that the critter has an official common name, but being a leaf beetle on goldenrod, it would probably be perfectly acceptable to call it the goldenrod leaf beetle.
I would think.
All right.
There you have it. Thanks, Brian. Sherry in Port Wing, on to you now. Hi.
Hi. I have been waiting for Phil's reappearance on your show because I've been carrying around in my wallet a drawing I made of an insect that no local person has been able to help me identify. He has shown up twice. In very early spring, just a single apparently adult insect. He's about 2.5 inches long, about almost 3/4 of an inch wide. His body appears to be very dark. I can't detect any wing or anything, just like a charcoal gray. He has 4 legs, equal sized, that are kind of a copper color. And he has 2 huge pincers coming out of the front of his head. And his 2 little eyes are sitting on top of his head, and they're like brilliantly shined onyx. And he's very slow moving. I've seen him last year and then again this year in an area that was heavily re-landscaped, and I don't know what he is. It's cold when I've seen him twice. I've had 2 witnesses every time. The first woman screamed when I picked him up and put him aside because I didn't want anyone to step on him. And, you know, nobody knows what he is.
Okay, taking a little bit of a shot at this, but the size, the beady eyes, and the kind of pronounced forelegs, it sounds like a giant water bug.
Really?
And giant water bugs in the spring will go from their overwintering sites, which might be lakes or rivers, and will be flying to ponds and other places. And one of the other names that I was taught when I was a student is some people call them electric light bugs because they're so strongly attracted to security lights that you see them, you know, inside people's garages and other places that don't seem to make much sense unless you understand this light attractancy. So as I said, I would do a search on the internet and because they do have very distinctive eyes that sit up on the head.
Yes, right up on top.
And they are winged, but it's a real subtle the way they fold it and whatnot. You wouldn't think they're winged.
Uh-huh.
And if you were to look on from the front of it, it has a beak-like mouth part, and that's what it uses.
Yes, it does.
Yep. So I really strongly think it's one of the giant water bugs.
Oh, interesting.
Do you have that on your website?
Yes, I do. In my insect ID section, it's under big bugs because it is one of the bigger critters, and I do
big,
see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But totally harmless, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Other than I don't think I would put my finger in front of its mouth because, you know, they can feed on fish up to 4 to 5 inches in size, and I know the bite would be painful if, you know, it's not. They can't turn their head or anything, so it's not like they're mm-hmm. hard to handle. But if you do get too close, as I said,
I carried him both times in my hand to put him into a safe place.
most insects are pretty tolerant, although this one, and there's another one called a burrowing water bug that's not that common in Wisconsin. Boy, I'll tell you, that's worse than any bee sting I've ever had. And so some of those aquatic insects, I do definitely pay a lot of respect to.
And what's your website again?
I'm in the entomology department, so it's entomology, entomology, .wisc for Wisconsin, .edu. That will get you to our department webpage, and you can go through the menus there to go to the diagnostic lab. Or a quicker way, the same address and just a / ENTODIAG, which stands for the entomology diagnostic lab, and that will get you to basically my homepage. Then there's the ID section, the extension bulletins, and some of those things.
And all the pictures, and you'll see some nice pictures, I bet, on there, Sherry. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have an insect question, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Mary in Knowlton next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hi, I had a question about spittle bugs, and when I was on with the screener, it sounded like you were answering a question about spittle bugs. They did do look like they were doing some damage to my coneflowers and rubeckia by look like they were sucking out the juices from those plants. But it sounds like it's okay to they'll just be past their larval stage shortly and won't have to worry about it.
Right.
So I do have a question, though, about tent caterpillar. We have had them on our crabapple trees, and I'm not sure how to tell the difference. We think it was a tent caterpillar between that and a gypsy moth.
Okay. Well, two things. Gypsy moths will not make a tent.
Okay.
Gypsy moth also would prefer to bother your oak tree first before it gets to apples and the other. But if you see the larvae, they're both somewhat hairy worms. They're both somewhat dark base. But the tent caterpillar has a very distinct white line right down the back, like a racing stripe. and then it has some rather attractive bluish markings. They're not balls or dots, they're just markings. Now, if you look at a gypsy moth, maybe a little bit more grayer than a black base, and what's distinctive, no white lines, and they have six pairs of red dots and five pairs of blue dots. There's a pair per segment of their body, and then there's little spines and hairs coming out of these dots. So, you know, the timing of the year you find them is close to being the same. But again, anytime you have a tent in a tree, the thing about tent caterpillars, it's always flowering fruit trees and nothing else.
Okay.
Whereas, again, gypsy moth, poplar, oak, and then they will spill into things like your roses and other things. But really, it's oak is the number one thing I would expect them to bother. And
lots of tent caterpillars this year, it seems
like. Yeah, especially in rural areas. And, you know, that's an insect that's so easy to see. And I guess I normally tell people they overreact to it because you see that a plant's totally stripped out. And if you come back a couple weeks later, it will leaf out with not too much damage associated with it. The other thing about it is that I can assure you that they start to hatch as soon as it starts to leaf out. And most people, if they try to deal with it, they're about 3 weeks later than they should be.
Okay.
So
how would you deal with it? Would you just leave it there? Or?
Well, you know, if it's a big tree that's not important, I let it go. If it's the crab apple in front of the front pitcher window, you know, you don't want it to get stripped. A couple thoughts is before the tree leaves out, if you go out and examine the tree, the egg masses are very visible. They will be around twigs about the size of your small finger to a little bit smaller, maybe 3/4 inch in length. They will be a swollen, black, shiny, and almost bubbly mass that completely encircles the twig. You can scrape that off with your hand or with a knife, and what you're doing is taking a tent out there. Second thought is as soon as it leaves out, the tents are very small, the size of a golf ball or smaller. You can go there and, again, take a piece of newspaper and crush them or deal with them. Once they get as large as a basketball and the worms are more dispersed, then, you know, there are lots of sprays that can work. But to me, it's so much easier to deal with them. They're, you know, somehow remind yourself every spring, check that crabapple tree early when it's just starting to leaf out, before it even flowers. And I think you can take it out. You can prune it out sometimes. It just depends where it's located.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Kevin in Rhinelander emailed us and says, we have been inundated by earwigs the past several summers. Last summer, I checked my garden at night and find earwigs feeding on tomato and cucumber plants. We can decrease their numbers by spraying with an insecticide like 7, but enough survive to create severe problems with all of our flowering or flower-filled pots and hanging baskets. Always seem to be able to get into the soil and kill the plants by feeding on the root system, he says. Can anything be added or soaked into the soil that will kill the earwigs that make a home for themselves in the roots?
Well, you know, one of the things I often suggest to people when they have earwig problems is rather than spraying the plants is to spray the mulch, and in this case, the pots themselves instead, because that's where the earwigs are hiding. During the day. And it really isn't so, you know, 7 would be appropriate. Bifenthrin, permethrin. I mean, most of the landscape sprays have what it takes to deal with earwigs. It's how you apply it. And so, you know, I often suggest in this case, and I don't like this as a normal method of applying insecticide because it's usually a waste, but these hose end attachments that you put the insecticide in and turn your hose on. So you're putting on volume. You're putting on gallons of mixed product. And that's the kind of thing you need to spray, you know, along the foundation and your flower beds, and in this case, even over the pots. And that will take care of them.
Okay.
And you know, you can normally figure down in the Madison area, it's usually around Memorial Day. It can't be too much later than that up in Rhinelander when the half-grown earwig nymphs are coming out of the ground and they're starting their thing. If you ever want to know if they're in the neighborhood, just go look at marigolds, because that's a plant that they will just absolutely ravage given the chance. I'm a little surprised the comments on the tomatoes. That's one of the less favorite things that I expect to see them on. Hostas get hit pretty hard. It's interesting in our perennials around the house. You just find some things that they really like. In fact, I just treated our lambs here because they were getting chewed on pretty good. As I said, I think the mistake people make is not treating where they're hiding during the day, and that will go a long way in taking care of things.
Let's go to Don in Manawa next. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Say, I have a pretty extensive garden, and I have a problem with three different plants this year. It mustard plant, turnips and radishes. All the leaves are getting chewed pretty good with holes in them. Plus, I also have something getting into the radishes and the turnips. Can't see any insects, but they're leaving dark trails. Some kind of grub or worm.
Yeah,
that... my only suspicion. Once in a while, I see a little black fly hanging around there. I'm not sure if that's the culprit or not.
Yeah, you're real observant.
The least toxic thing to kill it.
Okay, well, this one's going to get us in a corner here because, to be honest, the critter that's causing the root damage is called a cabbage maggot, and the adult looks like a small housefly. And they lay their eggs in the maggots, tunnel in the radishes and anything in the crucifer group, and can either hurt it if it's a bulb type plant, or they will hurt the root. So I've seen cabbages and broccoli die from this. The problem is that we don't have a soil insecticide, whether it's organic or not organic, that's registered anymore for these kind of things for homeowners. It used to be diazinon for those people that used synthetic chemicals, but that's been taken off the market. And we are basically between a rock and a hard place. There are some nematodes you can buy and other things, but they really are kind of tricky to work with. And so I don't have an easy answer. The above ground stuff, I'm wondering if it's flea beetles, if they're small holes. If they're bigger holes, there is a red turnip beetle that will feed on those things, but I would expect you to see the turnip beetle. It's a red with three black lines, and it would just be sitting on the plant munching when you show up. Whereas the flea beetles are kind of subtle because they're so small, they jump, they're real nervous little guys. That, if you're on the organic side, rotenone would be pretty good. Spinosad probably would help to some degree. If you use synthetic chemicals, 7 or any of the pyrethroids that are registered would work. But as I said, I'm really at a loss considering where we're sitting with registered pesticides for homeowners to come up with a soil treatment. You can manipulate things a little bit by planting date. We know that about the time the lilacs bloom, the cabbage maggot first generation is coming on strong, and that's the worst time to set your plants out. But the problem for a longer season crop, like the turnips and whatnot, they're sitting there long enough, and there are multiple generations of cabbage maggot. Some people use floating row covers. I know people have tried a number of things. But right now, as I said, I don't have a solution for that one.
Okay.
Now, would that also be bothering my cabbage? Because I don't have problems with cabbage or my lettuce at all.
Let us know. Cabbage, the roots. And it just depends. Usually, if you can get the plants established and get a good root structure before the cabbage maggot shows up, you're not going to see much problem. The biggest problem, again, is very young plants. They come in and they tunnel in the roots, and then you will see the plants wilt. And usually then when you dig them up, you will see, a half a dozen or more maggots kind of rooting around in that tissue.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Dan in Madison.
Hi. I live in Columbia County. 3 years ago, we had a terrible hailstorm, hail about the size of baseballs. I've got 4 pretty good-sized red pines out in front of my house. Last year, you could walk by it and you could hear something chewing under the bark,
mm-hmm.
and it was leaving little holes. The DNR forester up in Columbia County told me it was a bark beetle. Now I've got 4 dead red pines out in front of my house. About 100 yards away, I've got 5 acres of red pine. Do I need to worry about those bark beetles going over there? It costs an arm and a leg to have all those trees taken down.
Well, the thing about the bark beetles, in fact, once the tree starts to die, I've got some other insects that show up that make lots of noise and kick stuff out. But bark beetles are relatively small. The best way to describe, when you look at the tree, it looks like somebody hit it with a shotgun with about a number 2 pellet.
That's what it looks like.
Yep. And that's the emergence holes. And the thing about bark beetles is they take advantage of stress.
Right.
And the stress that I was seeing, I'm sure that there was some stress associated with the hailstorm, but, we had significant summer droughts up until last year. And so a lot of the trees, I'm seeing oak trees dying, I'm seeing hickory trees dying from bark beetles, and they're different species, but they're all related to what we thought was drought stress. But now we've got into some decent rainfalls at the right period of time. In trees that are happy and healthy have their own defense against these bark beetles. So in this case, it may be hard to identify exactly what was going wrong with those red pines to weaken them enough to let the bark beetles get in. But for the trees that you've got out on the rest of the property, I bet you not. I bet you, as I said, that they're probably getting strong enough now. And the defense mechanism, if you ever cut a pine tree, you notice how within seconds it starts to pitch,
right,
and bleed. Well, that's the defense the tree has against bark beetles. When they try to burrow in, they get pitched out. But if the tree is weakened, it doesn't have that defense, and that allows my little friends to establish. So, as I said, you know, it could have been a planting site complication, or, you know, we always ask the question, has there been any kind of construction in the last 5 to 6 years, any kind of pipe work, root pruning, those kind of things. Those are all examples of stress. But generally, in a forest situation, if we are still dry, I'd say we pray for rain. I mean, it's not something we normally fight chemically, mm-hmm. although it's too bad. If we would have known on those trees near property that they were coming, there would have been potentially some things to do. But, you know, pines are so hard to work with because by the time you see they're brown, they're already dead.
These are 50 feet tall, and they started dying from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said, I know drought is at least a part of the story there. I can't guarantee that it's all the story that weakened them up. And, you know, I'll definitely say the bark beetles were the final straw to kill them. But I always try to walk this one back and say, what weakened the tree enough to let the bark beetles to get in the first place?
Okay, so now I don't need to, the emerald green borer, I don't need to worry about cutting these down right away and covering them with plastic or burning them?
No, with pine trees, where the story is that next spring, if you still have all this stuff around, you get a little nervous that it's a bit of a nursery that they can come up from. And so if you get the opportunity, it would not hurt to, you know, get them cut before next mid-May. And to be honest, it would also not be a bad idea to tarp them, which is a way of kind of cooking the insects out.
Right.
But it doesn't definitely have to be done in a short period of time. I, again, would use that window 15th of May. Do something before that next year.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dick in Bessemer, Michigan, it's your turn now. Hi, Dick.
Hello. I would like a description of the emerald ash borer and how you can distinguish it from other look-alike insects, the adult ash borer.
Well, the thing about I tell people is, you know, we talk about the bright green emerald color. They're long and skinny looking, but I've got a bunch of insects that fit that way. And I'll be honest with you, if you get emerald ash borer, the symptoms are going to be your dying ash trees. You're not going to see the adults. I mean, that's the general rule here, that very unlikely that somebody's going to see a bug at their screen or their window and it be the emerald ash borer. The Agrylis beetles, the group it belongs to, are kind of real nervous, fast-flying things. They just don't stick around. But it's about 11 millimeters long, which puts it somewhere in the neighborhood of, a little under a half an inch. It's very long and skinny. It is bright green, like a piece of jewelry. Now, we have other things like tiger beetles, and there are some leaf beetles and whatnot that are bright green, but they're short and fat, or they're much bigger than that. And so, as I said, so on the tree side, the dead giveaways, the things that we get so excited about, because there's other things that kill ash trees. They leave a D-shaped hole that is an eighth of an inch in diameter. And if you peel the bark back, it is this S-shaped winding of trails. Those two things are dead ringers. You know you absolutely have it if you see that in ash. And as I said, the adult stage, you know, it's good to show it to people, but that's not what we're finding. And that's what I wouldn't expect the average person to find.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, too. Chuck in Viroqua emailed us and says, I'm certain that certain hairy caterpillars in Southeast Asia can cause skin reactions when touched by humans. Are there any caterpillars in the Midwest that cause similar reactions? And if so, would you describe their appearance, maybe their habits and distribution?
Well, a general rule, if you've got caterpillars that got spines on, be careful. Now, a lot of times these spines are not harmful, but we call these urticating hairs on some types of caterpillars. The experience is like a stinging nettle, you know, and what happens is the hairs break and release a poison or venom. The Io moth is probably the most infamous one. It's not a real common moth in Wisconsin, but the caterpillars get 2 inches long. They're kind of a middle green, but they have all these funny spines and spikes out of the body. And so anytime I see that, I'm always a little cautious. And this is, you know, when children are picking up things, you don't want them to have a bad experience. There are a handful of other species, but then there are plenty of fuzzy caterpillars and even spine things like morning cloak caterpillars that are absolutely harmless. But that's the kind of thing you worry about. As I said, if you see funny kinds of little branch spines and the like, it may be one of these ones. The other thing that you see on some caterpillars, they don't have to have the poison, but in some caterpillars, their defense is these hairs break off. And so it's like not as bad as a cactus spine, but similar. And,
yeah.
and what you tend to get is a rash, okay. you know, with all these. Even gypsy moth will cause that kind of rash if you handle them sometimes on some people. And so, so you know, if people are picking up little fuzzy, spiny caterpillars, it doesn't hurt to use a piece of paper or something else to get the caterpillar on and observe it and whatnot, rather than touching it directly with your skin because of the potential. Now, it's definitely true there's far more caterpillars with this kind of urtication and whatnot in the tropics. And I've even read of a couple cases because of complications, people have died because of their exposure.
Boy.
But that's a real odd association. Makes a great science fiction movie, but it is not something I normally am concerned about.
Jack in Kenosha has a question for you. Hi, Jack.
Hi, good morning. Always a very informative show. Thanks so much. I want to go back to 10 caterpillars. I'm sorry. I've got them on every bush in my property, anything. And you were talking about mostly having them on fruit trees, and they're just on everything. I have an ortho sprayer on the end of a hose, and I went out and got some new spray. I have one bush so high it's over the my gutters, higher than that, and I can't get to the top of it. But if I spray everything that I can and soak it well, should I be pretty safe then from these things? Because I've seen them just decimate trees in our area. So.
Yeah, well, a couple things. I mean, there are other tent caterpillars. There is a forest tent caterpillar that we've had outbreaks with in parts of the states historically, but that doesn't make a tent, first of all. And that primarily is an oak and poplar feeder and some other things.
Okay.
In the eastern tent caterpillar, you know, things like chokecherry, wild plum, other things that people don't often associate as fruit trees are still hosts.
Okay.
And so we'll see it. And I have seen them feed on rose, but that's only when they're just absolutely terrible everywhere and they run out of food. So
they're on everything in my yard, every bush,
well,
any kind of bush.
Well, you know, one of the things that you'll see when they start to get full grown, they're about 2 inches long, and they will crawl off the tree and they'll crawl on all kinds of things.
No, these aren't that long. These are less than an inch long, and they're constantly descending on a, you know, like on a string from the bushes going to the ground.
Oh, I'm nervous. It's gypsy moth.
It is gypsy moth.
Because
okay.
because of the time of the year in particular, because the tent caterpillar should be pretty much finishing off
okay,
gypsy moth right
it
now.
Is gypsy moth, but they're making tents, though, but they're, Well, we have a street where it's in a non-residential area, but the trees are just full of them and dying. It looks like a dead block when
okay,
you drive
well,
by.
Well, again, you know, if you defoliate a tree 1 year, you expect it to leaf out again. If you defoliate a tree 2 years in a row, then you start to get enough of a stress that I worry about other things. But just to make sure what we've got, I'd be more than happy if you can get a digital camera and just get a couple pictures of one of these crawling on, you know, the side of the house or on a trunk and just send it to me so we can make sure. I'm hoping it's tent caterpillar because, as they said,
I live on the south side of Kenosha, and they've been spraying for tent caterpillars, but do you think I have to call the city about it? Or
not this late. Because they said, to me, spraying right now doesn't make any difference as far as the tree health is concerned. The damage has been done.
Okay.
But there's
not too much. I mean, they haven't eaten too much of the bushes that they're on, but I just started spraying this morning, and so
yeah.
I'm hoping to at least halt their progress a bit.
Well, the size of the worms concern me because, you know, if everything's a half to three-quarters of an inch, no matter who it is, it's got another couple weeks of feeding. If
okay.
things were full-grown, I'd say don't bother. They're just hanging out. They're going to spin their cocoons and be done feeding on things. But, yeah, it would be worth getting it. Most communities will not spray for tent caterpillar. Most communities will consider spraying
for gypsy moth. Yeah,
okay.
I would bet that they're spraying for gypsy moth.
Yeah, they have been, yes.
Yeah.
And the sprays don't always, you know, we had the unfortunate case in Madison that, you know, the sprays went on and you know, there's such a small time frame you can get them on and the weather doesn't cooperate. The bottom line is even areas that were sprayed in the city, we were having quite a bit of activity of gypsy moth. They weren't knocked down as well as we would have liked.
No. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling, Jack. Appreciate your call as well. And Mike in Menominee Falls is up next with a question for you, Phil. Hi there, Mike.
Hi. I got a question about ants. We all have them around our properties and all, but I have a three-seasons room up here that's all got a boarded ceiling. and I noticed they're up in one of the, right in the top, there's a little ledge on the top of our sun porch, and I noticed the last few days there's granules coming down onto the windowsill. And I looked up there, and there's ants going back and forth up there, crazy. I've done this for just about a week or two, and I put some poison up there. But what I'm trying to find out, are these guys eating the wood up there?
No, I'm guessing they're carpenter ants, and the name is deceptive because they don't eat wood for a living. But if you've got some wood that has softened up, usually because of water damage or weathering, that's what they nest in. They nest in an old rotting stump, and they'll do the same thing. And so it's a sign that not everything is totally sound, although... Yeah, you know, we've talked about it before. Sometimes I've seen it in the pink or blue foam board is what they're nesting in because that's another soft substrate. So they're kicking out little particles of pink and blue styrofoam. And so it's a sign of where the nest is. And that's the most important thing to know about carpenter ants is where the nest is because there's a single queen. And if you kill her, the nest is taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
For a colony like that, I prefer to use a dust. I know it's a little bit more hard to work with, but I can find if you can get a dust and blow it into where the nest is, you get better effect than trying a spray that sometimes doesn't penetrate as well.
Mm-hmm. This was done before we bought the house, but the three-season room on the top is just half-inch plywood, and they painted it and all that, and it's screwed in there. Maybe I could be able to drop this down and take a look in there.
Sure. Well, you know what I always tell people, you can almost play devil's advocate with a carpenter ant colony like this and say they've done you a favor, because if you've got a water issue, that's the important part is being a homeowner. And the ants are just taking advantage of an environment. And sometimes this is the problem, people have had a leak problem, they have it fixed, it still compromised some of the wood. So we might see a colony 4 or 5 years after the fact. So it doesn't mean that there's a water problem now. But usually, soft rotting windowsills, door frames, anything that starts to get a little soft and punky is exactly the environment they want to move into.
That doesn't make sense because last year, every great once in a while, we had a little ice damming problem in this corner.
And
yes. A little bit of water would got in. So if that softened that wood up, that should get addressed. Yes, okay, I understand. Thank you very much. That tells me a lot.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today, answering your bug questions. And here's another one via email from Tracy in Wausau. Found this bug growing 2 seasons ago and all over her bean vines and corn. Hadn't seen them before or since, about the size of a dime, according to the picture she sent. What do you think, Phil?
Well, the critter that she sent is black with orange and yellow striping on the abdomen, but to be honest, it's the immature stage of a green stink bug.
Ah.
And we did have a lot of stink bugs 2 years ago, and they do feed on the fruits of things, and so they could cause a little bit of pod deformation in beans. They can cause some dimpling in apples and other things. Stink bugs are typically more of a southern insect, and so I don't normally see a lot of problems, but for whatever reason, it was one of the top 4 or 5 problems that I saw 2 years ago. And again, it's not something that we expect to be an annual problem. And seeing a couple of them, what makes it a little difficult is when the nymphs are out, you often see them clustered. So it's like they're ganging up on a plant. Excuse me. But once they transform into the adults, they tend to fly off and be less of a concern.
Let's go to Dave in Mequonago next. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning. We've got these green insects about a half inch long. They're fluorescent green almost. Triangular head, pretty fast runners. When you get close to them, they take off and fly. And I don't know if you know what they are, if I'm describing them well enough, and also, would they do damage to the foliage on a Norway maple?
Okay, well, I'm guessing at a couple things here. There is a critter called an imported green weevil, which will feed on various, I see it on apples, but I've also seen it on raspberries, and it'll eat little tiny notches in the edges of leaves. It could also do that on maple, if that was the critter. But are you seeing most of the critters on the ground, or most of the critters on plants?
Most of them on the ground, and they like to be on sidewalk and driveway. concrete.
Well, you know, if they're starting to flush as much as you say, then I don't think it's this green weevil, because it tends to be, I would classify it more than slow than fast. If the insects are a little bit nervous when you're around and they go fly up and, you know, fly 15, 20 yards down and then stop, I wonder if you got tiger beetles. Real neat group of critters. They're related to our ground beetles. They are predators by nature. Very fast running and very fast flying. And again, some of them are bright like a piece of jewelry. And that's definitely one of the insects we see submitted as a potential emerald ash borer. So you know, if you did an internet search on tiger beetles, the shape and size, you know, would show you right away because they're very distinctive.
All right.
That's kind of what I thought they were. I've already done the internet search, and I was kind of looking for some confirmation on it. Are they common around this area? This is really the first year I've seen a lot of them around.
If you get in the right spot, normally if I go looking for tiger beetles, it's more in sandy areas. And to be honest, there's a trick among entomologists. If you want to collect them, it takes two people. Because what you'll normally see is when you flush them, they'll fly out ahead of you, and they'll stop and turn and land looking at you. So while they're real busy kind of keeping an eye on you, you have your friend sneak up from behind and net them. And, so
that's exactly what they do. They'll take off, and they'll go about 6, 7, maybe 8 feet, and they'll touch down. And you can just keep moving them across your yard like that.
Yeah. Now, are you on lighter soils or not?
I'm in kind of sandy soil.
Okay. Yeah. I said, for whatever reason, there is a couple species we find in the forest, but generally speaking, we have more diversity in some of the sandy areas. And it's just a neat critter.
They wouldn't cause any damage to foliage on the trees.
No, they're a predator. So they'll eat caterpillars and other things that would, so they're definitely a beneficial.
They're a good thing.
Okay, good. Excellent. Thank you very much for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Jim and Lafarge, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Howdy. For about 4 to 6 weeks in May and June, our spruce trees around the tree were just buzzing. They were completely filled with what looks like those sandhill hornets or whatever, about an inch long, yellow with the black stripes, black and yellow stripes and a black diamond. And they were just in the trees all day long, and the only thing they would ever do was, when we watch them, would they periodically land at a branch and that? And we're just wondering, what were they doing?
Okay. Now, this is in May and June?
Yeah, this was, it started about the second week of May, maybe the third week of May, and it ended about a week and a half ago.
Okay. Well, the timing is a little off what I normally would expect, but hornets and yellow jackets do have a real fondness for sweets. And I'm wondering if you had some bud scale or some other insect that was sucking the juices out. And you know, when you get aphids or scales, sometimes you get this shiny, sticky residue, both on the plant leaves, but also on things underneath it. And the hornets are taking advantage of it. So I wonder if you had some scales that were excreting some of this honeydew, and the yellow jackets or wasps were feeding on that. And then as the scales mature and stop this excretion, there's nothing to eat, so they don't show up anymore. So normally when I get the complaint on spruce, that's what it turns out to be, is that there's some scale, or if it's, you know, a maple tree, it could be an aphid or something else that's generating this sugary water that's attracting the bees and wasps.
Okay, that's cool. I don't have any problem with them. I was just curious.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Thanks a lot for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Evelyn and Phillips used her BlackBerry to send us a note and a photo of an insect she saw last week with a blue head and yellow and blue body. And is it on irises? Sitting on it.
Yeah. Wow. At first I had to kind of double take here on what the critter. I thought it was going to be a blister beetle, but it's not. It looks like something that I would call an elderberry borer. And it's a longhorn wood boring beetle, and elderberry borers are not real common. In fact, they're kind of trophies for people that collect insects. But it's quite common for many of the cerambycids to be found on flowers. They do a little bit of pollen feeding. This particular thing is not a pest in any sort or form that I know about. But you know, it's kind of long and skinny. It's very long antennae, usually as long as the body, which is rather characteristic. And this particular species has a lighter colored shoulder to it. Which is again, so if it's who I think it is, that's the critter, and I will tell you, I don't think I have ever caught one in my life.
Oh!
So it's kind of a, as I said, it's kind of a trophy, although I don't really collect critters anymore other than taking pictures of them, but that one looks pretty neat.
Let's go to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I was at my farm last weekend, and my daughter and I were sitting out there, and this bug flew onto the rail, and it was bright emerald green. And I was wondering if it was an emerald ash borer. Do they fly?
Oh, yes. But, again, we were talking earlier, even in the family, the metallic wood-boring beetle family that it belongs to, there is probably about another five or six large, quite a bit larger, bright green, or in some cases almost a goldish green color. And so, you know, it's hard for me to say, but the likelihood it is a different species and not the emerald ash borer. It's, as I said, I could probably easily come up with 20 species of insects in the state that are every bit as bright green, and some that are shaped in a very similar manner, usually larger than the emerald ash borer. I mean, some of these metallic wood borer beetles will get a half inch, three quarters of an inch, almost a full inch in size.
Smaller. And we're near Newburgh. Jackson is not too far from Newburgh, and I was just wondering if it was.
Well, you know, they are flying. They are flying now. You know, the adults start to come out, and but it's just interesting that even with, you know, all the problems in Newburgh and in the traps up, very few beetles were caught in the traps. They said it's, you know, if you really know what you're looking for and you sat and watched an ash tree and looked at the insects landing on the leaves, then potentially you could find one. I'd be more suspicious, but just a random bright green insect, the likelihood is it's not EAB.
All right.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Don in Fond du Lac. On to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi. Hi. Great show again, guys.
Thanks.
We were in northern Wisconsin this past weekend with some friends, and we noticed what I would think is a moth. It's about an inch long. It's white with some mauve, kind of lavender trimmings on its head on its wings with a bright yellow head. And I was curious if you knew what that was. None of us really could pinpoint it.
It has to be one of the tiger moths, I'm guessing, but I'm not quite sure without seeing exactly which one it is. In fact, to be honest, it's a more drab color, but even the woolly bear caterpillar, the traditional band of woolly bear, turns into a type of tiger moth. So, you know, that whitish and then the distinct markings on both the thorax and the head would suggest to me it's one of the tiger moths.
Okay, this was solid white with, like I say, moth striping on the wings with a head as yellow as butter.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way. So that would be a tiger moth.
Right. And you know, a lot of the other species, as the name implies, are, you know, the classic tiger moths are black with almost tan striping and even some kind of dull reddish markings. But there are members in that family that are all white, or basically the wings are all white. And then, as I said, the bodies can have some distinct markings on them.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Margaret emailed us. She lives near Sun Prairie, was plagued by a flying insect in May. Every time she went outside to walk through her garden during May, she'd end up with very small somethings flying around her head. They got into her hair, they would bite, but she wouldn't feel it. The only sign I had that they bit me is that I or someone else would notice a long trickle of blood from the bite site. Then I'd end up with a swollen lump that was very itchy and lasted over a week.
So I bet you Larry knows this one. Classic black flies.
Yep, classic black flies.
You know, and the problem, we associate them with streams and rivers, but you can be far away because they do blow in. And, you know, they look like a fruit fly, a little bit more shoulder to them. So I tease about them being fruit flies on steroids, but that's their mode of operandus is to bite around the head area, the neck area. You don't feel the bite necessarily, but you get the trickle of blood because of the anticoagulants that they inject.
Yep.
And then because of all this garbage they leave behind in your system, your body reacts, and some people get just nasty welts that take 2 or 3 weeks to go away. I was talking to a gentleman that was helping us out putting some new windows in our home. He had been up in the Boundary Waters, and he just raved about a product that he used to keep the black flies away. And so I was real interested in it, and so he had shown me the bottle, and it did contain 25% DEET. But in addition, it had two other repellents, MGK, I think one was 365, and the other was MGK 264, if I remember the numbers. And he said, you know, best he's ever seen. And so I'm real intrigued on getting a hold of some of this and trying it myself. But they just sprayed it on their cap line, you know, and it
that
kept the black flies away. And again, it has more than the standard DEET, so I'm kind of intrigued that this combination might be what you take. But we definitely tell people, wear hats. I mean, that protects you a lot. Also, nice windy days are great to go out because the black flies are weak flyers. It's more when things get still that you're more at risk.
And she also wonders if it's too late to put a systemic in the ground around her hops to prevent the hops from being eaten by Japanese beetles.
the systemic is a little slow to get up into the plant, but I don't say it's too late. You know, we're about 10 days away from, well, maybe not even that, a week away from Japanese beetles starting, but they'll continue to intensify. So I would get it on now, and I think you will definitely get a benefit for it. It's just that first week or so, you might get a little bit of feeding before it really moves up into the plant. But then the other thing, of course, using a systemic like that in the hops, you can't harvest the plant. I mean, it's not, the yeah. product is not registered for things that are typically used for human consumption. As it, just think about it, the insecticide's moving inside the plant sap. You don't want to harvest and utilize any parts.
Would it harm birds that eat the seeds?
No, okay. It doesn't go there. There is a little bit of documentation that plants that are in flower, that bees have picking up some of this product, and it's not necessarily toxic straight out. Some people have even said that this it causes behavioral problems in the bees, and is this part of the colony collapse? To be honest, colony collapse is far more difficult, and this is not involved with that.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Happy to have you listening in today. And if you have a question, join us at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And Neil has been waiting a while from Waupaca, and he has a question, I believe, about ants. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Phil. Actually, my question is about gnats with a G.
Oh, gnats. All right.
We live, well, like you said, Waupaca, and we're out in the country on a farm with a bunch of horses. And the only bad thing about it is that you can't go outside without getting your eyeballs filled up with gnats. And we don't know what to do about them. Is there predators that feed on these things? I've looked them up. I can't really find anything. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Well, right. You know, gnat is kind of a generic term to an entomologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it most likely is a small fly of one sort or another. But then my question is who is it and where does it come from? The short answer is I bet you there's not a whole lot that can be done, but it would be interesting to know. So I'd be happy if you catch some little critters and just mail them down to the lab and I can take a look at it, at least hopefully give you some more background and try to explain what they're coming from. Sometimes it is something, you know, if it's something that breeds on spent hay and you clean yeah. up the hay, it goes away. But probably the most common gnat we get are lake flies, which are insects that come off of water systems. And boy, you can get mass emergences at times. There are little tiny lake flies. There are large lake flies. It's a big family. And you can't poison the water, and that's no. what it would take to get rid of them. So, but as I said, I think it'd be well worth it. You can send the insect lab. The address is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. University zip is 53706. And they said, then if I can see exactly what you got, then at least maybe we can figure out why, and then we'll see if there's an option.
And thanks again for that call. Shirley and Prentice, on to you now. Hi, Shirley.
Hello, Larry. Thank you. I've heard so many odd things about ticks this year, and maybe Bill can debunk some of them. A couple things. Do guinea hens eat them? Are there any predators that eat them? And do they fall from trees onto people when they see someone underneath?
Sure. Guinea hens, just the way they forage, do feed on ticks. And so that is, you know, a way of cleaning out the yard, at least. They do have other predators, spiders, all kinds of things, ground beetles. There's even some parasitic wasps that attack them. But ticks play the numbers game that you see so often with insects and their relatives, in that a female tick will lay 2,000 to 3,000 eggs. And so all those little ticks, most of them die before they become adults, but all you need is a couple to make it through. And so it's always that number game. Most of the time, I don't expect them to drop from up above. Ticks tend to like to sit in long grass and the like and wait for their prey to come by. They're blind, but they respond to heat, movement, and carbon dioxide. And what they'll do is latch on. And I think why most people think that they're falling from up above is that if you're out there in a pair of pants and a shirt, when the tick gets onto your pants, it crawls upwards. And the first place it's going to find a place to set up housekeeping is on your neck. And so people often get them high on their person, yeah. thinking, well, they started from up there. But as I said, if I want to go get ticks, we get an old wool blanket and we drag it along in the grass and the shrubbery and whatnot and catch them there. They're not up in the trees and whatnot.
I had an email from somebody the other day about tick removal. And this email, this emailer said that if you took liquid soap and if you've got a tick bored in a little bit, you take liquid soap, put it on a cotton swab, and then just dab it over the tick for 10, 15 seconds, that it'll come right off.
The people at Ohio State had done research on all the home remedies, and the bottom line is they didn't find anything that really improved. Now, part of it, though, is you got to look at what's going on with a tick, and it really depends on what kind of tick. Deer ticks, because of the way their mouth is constructed or their feeding apparatus, are far more difficult to remove because it's longer, so it goes in deeper. Yeah. It's also multiple barbs on it, like a fish hook, and in the case of the deer tick, they glue it in. So you've got this really difficult to pull it out. Now, with a wood tick, their mouth part is quite a bit shorter. They don't glue it in, and so they're easier to dislodge. And if a tick has just got on your person and really hasn't got that dug in deeply, they will back out. So, you know, using oils and soaps, I can see where maybe we'll speed that up a little bit. But if a tick is really attached in serious feeding, none of these things help. And again, the question that they brought up at the Ohio State paper was the potential for introducing infections. You know, and then, of course, people burning them, and that was a real no-no. The other thing they tried, some people said, well, you turn them to the right or you turn them to the left like it's a screw, and that's not the way the mouth part is structured at all.
There you have it. All right, Cindy in Bear Valley. Hey. Hi to you.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hey, we have a problem with rose chafers. We have a few cows, fields, woods, and a small orchard, and there are millions of them, it seems. Mm-hmm. We've tried a few sprays. Somebody suggested we get traps. We tried a few traps a few years ago, and we still have millions of them.
Well, the problem is, you know, the traps, to be honest, I really do have some faith in, as far as taking some of the pressure off your plants. But the problem with rose chafer is they're breeding in the areas around you, which you have no control. So every year it's like a new game.
Okay.
So you will not eliminate them with the traps. The other thing about traps is you want to move them far enough away from the plants, like the orchard and whatnot. You don't want to put the traps in the middle of the orchard because you're drawing them in. But it sounds like you've got a big enough property. And the rose chafer traps, unfortunately, take a little bit of legwork to find. There's a company called Great Lakes IPM in Michigan, which I know sells them. In fact, as far as I'm aware, they're the only source.
Okay.
And so you'd have to buy a new lure every year. The basic trap part of it, though, you can use from year to year. And as I said, I think if you use them and set them up, you should be able to drastically reduce the amount of damage you've got. But realizing, again, you've got no control of the breeding. So next year, you got to do it again, and it will stay that way.
Oh, okay. Once they're here, they're here.
Right. And, you know, we only see them on sandy soils. You know, so if you've got neighbors, even in the same county, that are in a heavier soil area, they don't even know what you're talking about.
Right.
Know,
but we've talked to other apple people, and they have no idea.
Right, right.
Okay. Okay, we'll give that a try again.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate the call. And Rick and Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. How are you? Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I was wondering about these infestations like the carpenter ants or the gentleman with the pine trees that he has to wrap. Would you be able to dump blocks of dry ice, let's say in a bowl and attach it to the ceiling, or in chunks and put it underneath the tarping to suffocate the ants? Would that work?
Well, two things. The dry ice itself, if you got close enough, the cold would kill them. But carbon dioxide will. You know, you get high levels. And
so, like, if you had bugs or something on your plants, if you could wrap your plant and, of course, keep the cold of the ice away and just move the carbon dioxide to fill that envelope,
it wouldn't hurt
the plant.
Right. Yeah, plants I'd be a little nervous just because I don't know if high carbon dioxide levels will affect some growth potential. But the same remedy I have seen the people out in California have a one of the remedies for clothes moths on very expensive oriental rugs is to wrap them in a large bag and put some dry ice and basically kill them with it's a fumigation technique
is what it is.
Exactly. So, yes, it does have some potential if you can hold the gas properly and get the levels up. And so, as I said, there are some, I don't know if I'd call them home remedies, but things that people can do with it if you use your head and understand how it works. And as I said, it was interesting because clothes moths have been getting to be more of a problem in these very expensive rugs, and I thought that was a pretty neat solution.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks.
Hopefully it works for ants and won't cause water damage.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Rick. Bob and Claybanks, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for the show again, Larry.
Sure.
I just heard you mention that burning ticks is not a good idea. Is that more from the chance of introducing other infections into a wound? And what would be the best way to get them out if they've kind of been embedded?
Okay. Basically, their concern was the potential of burning skin, you know, that you could cause further injury that way. What the research suggests is you grab as close as you can to the skin level and to do a slow, steady pull. Now, I'll be honest with you, if you've had a deer tick on you for 2 days and you try that pull, most likely part of the hypostome will break off. And so it's like a sliver, potential for infection, something you'd rather not have there if you can help, but it's not the end of the world. And usually it will work its way out. I generally find because the mouth structure on wood ticks is so much shorter, they're much more easily removed without quite as much problem. But, you know, deer ticks, I even know in cases of people have had to go to urgent care or whatnot to get some aid where they have to take a scalpel and get enough of an incision to be able to get deep enough to get that hypostome out.
The last show that I did with Sandy Sawchuk, our veterinarian, at the UW Vet School, she uses just a little metal thing that looks like a little fork, very thin, and you can slide it. It's made for removing ticks, and you can slide it under the tick and kind of gently pry it out, and they sell them at places like pet stores and say Mounds, for example, would have them.
Yeah, I've had a couple variations on tweezers that people have invented and whatnot that, again, do something similar. But most of the time, if you don't have anything like that available, as I said, it really, the question is getting as deep and close to the skin as you can, pinching and pulling, rather than going to the abdomen and grabbing and pulling, because then what you're doing is forcing body fluids into your body, which if it, you know, has diseases and whatnot, there's more of a likelihood of transmission. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, she keeps hers on her keychain.
Ah, well, that's smart. You know, the problem with dogs and cats is, you know, they don't pick it up usually quite as quickly, so often the tick has been there for 2 or 3 days, and the issue is the longer they're there, the more that mouth part is kind of cemented stuck. In or stuck.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Let's hear from Charlie here in Milwaukee, who has an email. Every spring in downtown Milwaukee, where I live, thousands of tiny insects swarm to mate over my deck. At rest, their wings are folded over their backs, and one sex, the male, has longer feathery antenna, while the other has shorter, perhaps segmented antenna. What are they?
Yeah, I think that's one of the species of Chironomid lake flies. And again, with the water there, with the big lake, they will come off and all the lighting going on that draws them in. And the swarm is basically a mating technique. You get these clouds of males, and the females will come in and select a mate out of it. And oftentimes, swarms will congregate off of certain objects. You know, you might see them every day in the park 2 feet above the trash can, and they're there every afternoon for a week. And so it's really an interesting phenomenon. And I've seen pictures of swarms that are 15 feet wide, 100 feet high in the Canadian lakes. I mean, it's just amazing sometimes the sheer biomass or number of insects you can have. And unfortunately, as I said, there, other than praying for a good wind, there isn't a whole lot people can do. I mean, you can try to keep the lights down and the like, but not a whole lot more than that.
Betsy from Waukesha says, over the past few weeks, we've noticed many wingless gray bugs that are no more than a millimeter in size. We have found some around a bathroom window, some along the base of the patio door, and others crawling around our patio on our vinyl siding and on plants like peonies. We put in a backyard patio and filled it around 10 yards of dirt. That might be relevant, she says.
Mm-hmm.
In my research, I've come across springtails, and I'm wondering if that is a likely answer.
Well, springtails are little critters that jump, and so that would be the thing that would catch your attention first. I would suggest, I have on my website, under the extension bulletins, a bulletin called Nuisance Weevils. And there turns out that there's about 5 or 6 species of weevils that will develop. Usually their grubs are root-feeding insects. The adults emerge, and they crawl on everything. And they're kind of slow-moving. Many of them are flightless. It's interesting that some of those species are even all females. There are no males known. And so, as the name implies, they kind of get in things. They don't hurt anything. They're just hanging out, but just being present is not good. And there's some suggestions in there, at least of things to look at, is a way of somewhat slowing them down. But if it is one of those, and, you know, whether this is the imported longhorn weevil, which would somewhat fit that description, but there's a couple other species that would have. So that's where I would start to see if that's what we got, and at least it will help explain why you got the problem. And again, it, I don't think it has anything to do with the dirt.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. John, hello.
Hi, and thank you.
Sure.
I have field ants, three big mounds in the yard, and I looked for seven in the stores, and none of the seven packages mention ants on their labels. And I tried permethrin with a 0.25% solution, and it didn't faze them one bit.
Okay, did you just apply it to the top of the nest, or did you try to get it soaked in?
The direction said to water it in, and it said only a teaspoon and a half for each one. Well, I put two cups on there and watered it in according to the directions, and that still didn't bother them.
Okay. The seventh story is the label has been going through a transition. Seven used to be used on about five times as many things. They used to put it on dogs to get rid of fleas. It is a highly toxic product to ants, wasps, and bees. And so it depends a little bit on the seven label you get. You know, if it's for the vegetable garden, since ants aren't a vegetable pest, it probably won't be listed there. We can't use seven indoors anymore. And it's more just a labeling change. It isn't so much that they found, you know, lots of toxic issues with it. And so because of its efficacy against things related to bees and ants, that's one of the reasons I like it. And it usually has label for treating lawns. It usually has label for treating vegetables. It usually has labels for treating. So the site is there. The particular insect isn't, but that will still allow you to use it. But whether you use the seven or the permethrin, the thing that I think I would change in my treatments, you know, when I go after a big field ant nest, I'll mix the stuff up in a bucket at the normal dilution rates that they talk about. And for a big nest, it might be a gallon and a half or more of diluted product. But then I will usually take a rod or some kind of a broom handle and push down in the nest so that I'm making three or four channels. And this is all to aid in getting it down into the ground deep enough to really get at the queen and at the heart of the nest. What my fear is when you put things on the surface and try to wash them down, you don't wash them down very far. And that's why the stuff doesn't work. So the permethrin, I still would have some faith in. But as I said, I would make that adjustment of doing everything you can to get it as deep as you can. And one of the things we suggest with some of this stuff, if you've got pets and kids and you want to make it just a little bit safer, is you can go in and rake a little bit of that soil off the top, do the treatment, and then that untreated soil you move over the top as a cap. So we don't even have any exposed product. And as I said, to me, the secret is getting it deep. And I find it works a lot better to drench it on from a pail than to use any kind of sprayer.
All right. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, too. Let's see here. Paul emailed us, "My house and garage are consistently covered with spider webs full of gnats and such. My neighbors don't have the problem. The obvious difference is my house is sided with white vinyl and my garage white painted wood. If I scrub the siding down, it's only a matter of days before the mess reappears. The spiders I've seen are very small. What can I put on the siding to encourage them to hunt elsewhere?"
Okay, well, they're taking advantage of all the insects that show up. And so the first thing I would look at is your security lighting. You know, if you've got a light above the garage, you're drawing all those insects, and in the light-colored house even makes it even better because it kind of enhances. I mean, when we want to collect insects, we take a white sheet and shine the light onto the sheet, and all the insects come in that way. And so so sometimes you can get the same effect where you take the light and you put it on a pole and you shine it on the garage. The difference here is that the insects will go to the pole away from the building and not go there, and if there's no insects to eat, the spiders will be less of an issue. Then if you're going to the other side, that if you want to treat for the spiders, what you will find is the better products are either powders. And powders often will cause a little bit of staining or you know, at least a chalkiness on the house. Or microencapsulated is what we call them, where they're impregnated in little tiny capsules. The problem with that is I can't send you to Home Depot to buy it. These are the kind of products that pest control people would use. There are sites on the internet called Do Your Own Pest Control. And they will have these products available for spiders. They'll sell it as a concentrate, and you mix it and spray it on, especially under the overhangs and the like. And you will get 4 or 5 weeks at least of control over it. So it's the formulation that makes it better for spiders. But as I said, I would take a step back and see if there's some kind of physical adjustments you can make in your lighting. Even if you don't want to move your lighting, go to some of these less attractive bulbs, you know, some of the yellows and whatnot that are sold. They have less
UV, which is what draws the insects in. Some of the mercury vapors, too, are far less attractive than some of the standard bulbs that we use.
Marcia in Delafield, we're on to you now. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. I'm calling just out of curiosity more than anything else. I found some some sort of bugs in my front planting areas. They're kind of a teardrop shape, about maybe a 1/16 of an inch long, and they're kind of almost like a neon orangish pink, just sort of teeming like ants do. And I'm just curious what they – I've never seen them before. I was wondering what they would be and would they be doing any harm to anything that they're around.
Boy, the neon pinks got me stumped.
Yeah, they're straight. I've never seen anything like them before.
Yeah, they sound like immature nymphs of something, probably of a true bug, but I'm not quite sure what species. Be happy if either you send me some critters or you can take a pretty decent digital picture and
yeah,
then just
okay.
Email it to me, and then I should be able to give you a better answer.
Yeah, I was just out there now. It's real hot and sunny, and they're not nowhere to be seen. So maybe more like in the later day when it's a little cooler. I don't know. It's just they were around some little succulent plants that people you use to sort of keep the water off the windows. And they were maybe also some. My daughter planted some raspberry bushes. Those are the only new things I could think of that might they would be attracted to.
Sure. Although, it's, you know, sometimes we get these things, they're blowing off the trees and just kind of congregating. You know, if it wasn't for the neon pink, I would be suspicious of immature box elder bugs because the time of year is about right.
Oh, I bet that's what they are because we have a lot of those.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
then,
you know, they have more kind of, to me, an orangish red color.
That kind of, it's sort of a, orangish red would be right.
Okay. Yeah. So the good news is they won't hurt anything. They're just kind of hanging around. They feed on the seeds of box elder and... My take on it, if it stays as wet as it is, the box elder bugs are not going to be happy. They tend to get a disease if this happens.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob's a sheep farmer, emailed us, and noticed over the years that while maintaining electric fences for their grazing system, relative increase of ant nests under my fence compared to the rest of the pasture. The question is, are ants attracted to electromagnetic fields from electricity, or do they survive there because they are less disturbed there? I've noticed many ant nests under power lines as well while driving in the country.
Ah, I'm not sure what the answer is. That's a very interesting observation that he has. And, you know, insects definitely do respond to a lot of things. And so it would not surprise me that electromagnetic fields or whatnot may have some. You know, his first question about, you know, the fences keeping things away and whatnot also makes sense. So I'm not sure what the right answer is there.
Well, on that note, we have to close, Phil.
Yeah, just a couple things there. I'm going to be
yes.
at the West Madison Research Station tonight doing a garden walk for people who are interested, starting at 6:30. We'll be in Fond du Lac on the 25th of July doing there's a prairie festival there, and I'll be at the Neville Museum on the 12th of August giving a talk on spiders. They have a spider exhibition going on all this summer.
Oh, that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And when is your
starting 6:30 tonight at West Madison, so people can bring bugs in and whatnot, and be more than happy to take a look at them and just talk about what's going on.
The West Madison Research Center at
6:30.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and of course he'll be back hopefully in a month or so, and we'll talk some more with him about insects. I'm sorry we didn't get to this whole mittful of emails and all the other calls too, but that's what usually happens. Tomorrow we'll talk with one of the Crave brothers who is hosting Farm Technology Days coming up. Chuck Crave will be our guest from Waterloo tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.